Support for this program is brought to you by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hi, I'm Mitch Skinner, and tonight we're talking Bodies in Motion.
They're not going to hire for anything but a mammy or a kind of hypersexual character. My options are limited here, right? And I want to eat.
Yeah, I could eat stuffing by the bucket if I wanted to. But yeah, you don't want to be putting it in your coffee.
The big brown bear but a big black bug. Big brown bear but a big black bug. Big brown bear but a big black bug.
A body in motion will stay in motion unless acted on by an outside force. This is called inertia, and it's Isaac Newton's first law of physics. But what happens when physics collides with culture? Tonight we probe that question and look at three stages of motion: its acceleration, continuation, and final resting place. We'll explore movement in dance, commerce, and nature. We start at the start. It began with a performance at the MTV Video Music Awards. You know the one I'm talking about. Miley Cyrus and Robin Thicke singing We Can't Stop and Blurred Lines. Then, it exploded. Suddenly, everyone was talking about it. Newscasters, media analysts, bloggers, your parents. I'm talking, of course, about twerking. But what exactly is twerking? And who can do it? I talked to two experts to find out.
Stop for a second, please, Miley. Please, I beg you, just stop.
Diani with Jay Wadna tells me Miley Cyrus is ruining her business. That business is the Twerk Shop, located in Melbourne, Australia. It's sort of like a dance studio for twerking. Attendance is a little down since Miley got on stage. To add insult to injury, apparently Miley didn't even properly twerk it.
A YouTube video on my way to work, like at a stop sign, and I watched it and I thought I wasn't paying enough attention. So then I like pulled over and watched it again because I was so confused. So I'm like, she's not twerking.
The motion was all wrong. Miley Cyrus was grinding. Twerking requires more of a fine jiggle. Here's how it's done. First, you need to bend your knees. Then you lift your arms and stretch your back.
So you get that arch in your back when you stretch it out, and then you would need to lift the top part of your bum. You want to lift that into your back, and it's always on an up motion. So you go lift it up into your back and then drop it center. You don't want to go forward because then it looks like you're thrusting.
And I certainly don't want to look like I'm thrusting. I don't even want to look like I'm twerking. But I do want to know if I can twerk. From a physical level, yeah, I can totally do it. I'm not completely out of shape, and I have no back problems. But I'm also a guy, and some people think that means I should keep my butt to myself. But not with Jay Wadna.
Yeah, you can totally twerk. And that's the best part. Twerk Shop in itself, we are very aware that girls want to exercise in a fun way. You want to do a lot without knowing that you've done a lot. Thanks, Gen Y. And also, like, we get heaps of guys. We open the second class up to dudes because of that reason that, you know, guys do want to twerk.
My
milkshake brings all the boys
to the yard and they're like... And my 7th grade algebra teacher said I would never amount to anything. Well, look at me now, Mrs. Landis. I'm on top of the world, about to shake what my mama gave me. Except we're ignoring one thing. I'm white. And this is a problem for a lot of people. If you look up the reactions to Miley Cyrus at the VMAs, most of it isn't centered on her technical twerking ability. It's on her race. Apparently, twerking has roots in West African dance. And some think this means that Miley is appropriating black culture.
I feel conflicted only because if I were to define something as cultural appropriation, then I would be saying that I believe that's culture. Or I believe that's black culture. Mm. And I don't.
This is Brittany Lewis. She's a PhD candidate in the Feminist Studies Department at the University of Minnesota.
I don't believe that what she is emulating or co-opting or commodifying is Black culture, i.e. because I define kind of my understanding of Black culture very differently than I think pop culture and the mainstream media has done. And I would argue that these representations of Black women were not created by Black people.
Lewis equates these depictions to minstrelsy. It's taking Black people and turning them into something like a cartoon. And this is where Miley gets into trouble. It's not so much about her appropriating Black culture, but how she's doing it.
And then you see kind of the nation rewarding a lot of white artists, right, for doing, I guess what we're saying, is Black cultural music. And she used Black female bodies, right, to do that work. So, I mean, I think there's some critical questions to be asked here about the ways in which Blackness and Black bodies are being used for the advancement of whiteness in pop culture.
Here's the thinking behind the analysis. Miley Cyrus got on stage with Robin Thicke. Those two were at the forefront. Backing them up were two prominent props: teddy bears, which are literal objects, and Black female dancers, whose bodies were being used like toys.
And I think behind the history of Black women's bodies as kind of this commodified object, I guess she picked her right tool. But I think the problem is that when my students watched it, it was like, well, it's not a problem that Black women's bodies are being used as a tool, because we're used to that. It's a problem that Miley Cyrus is doing this because that's not what we expect of her as a white woman. I mean, that's even more problematic in my opinion.
It's a conflict of images, not culture. Because when various bloggers and internet commenters talk about who can twerk, it usually boils down to this: dark-skinned women, relatively fit, large butt. And that's not a culture. Dayani Wajay-Wadna fits this description, but she's far from being African-American.
I'm a Sri Lankan female, first-generation Australian. So, you know, should I be twerking if it's African-American? But I got a big ass and brown, so apparently it's okay, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel a little bit more justified as well because a Black guy told me about it. So, but then it's like, well, really, does that matter? You know, so at the same time, Miley, I'm sure, has plenty of Black friends if we really want to go down that line. And I'm sure that she started twerking because she wanted to appreciate what the culture was and not make fun of it.
What Wajay Wadna sees as a culture isn't tied to race, but to twerking itself. She considers it an art, like any other dance.
Oh, for sure not.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, and people that kid themselves and just, you know, try to hate. It's not even like a hater's gone hate. It's like it's a, okay, you're a hater because you're incredibly ignorant and because you have no idea what this is. And I'm not sticking up for this because this is my life. I'm sticking up for it because it's genuinely hard.
So twerking as an art form, then maybe the problem isn't that Miley Cyrus did it, but that she did it poorly?
Yeah, I think that she just didn't do it.
Yeah.
And I think the videos of her doing it were really cute, and it showed that she was trying to do it. Like, she wasn't particularly good, but she was trying, you know. That night she just wasn't trying very hard.
But Brittany Lewis thinks there's too much focus on Miley Cyrus's ability to twerk. She wants a more critical analysis of pop culture. Why aren't white men being depicted twerking? Why are dark-skinned Black women being used as props in music videos? Why is Kerry Washington on Scandal one of the only leading roles for a Black woman on television? And why is her character the mistress to a powerful white man?
The illusion of choice. I feel like if I am, for instance, a Black female actress, there are many actresses throughout history who have noted this. I might want to play a more empowering role, or I might want to show a different representation of Blackness, but if they're not going to hire for anything but a mammy or a kind of hypersexual character, my options are limited here, right? And I want to eat.
And Lewis says the audience isn't doing enough to convince studios that they're ready for an improvement, because often the loudest voices are those complaining about a white character in a book like The Hunger Games or Marvel Comics being depicted by a Black actor.
And for those that are ready, who are reading, unpacking, and questioning these representations, well, my questions are, where is your voice at? Because certain voices are predominating the discussion.
For Culture Cue, I'm Mitch Skinner. Fall is here, and with it comes apple picking, coffee sipping, and plenty of other great date ideas. But will you and your honey go for seasonal courtship or something a little more unique? New reporter Katie Bolin probes Minnesotans for their best autumnal date ideas.
Anything that involves coffee?
I don't know. Honestly, maybe a walk around Walker, maybe a picnic too.
Raking leaves.
Yeah, I'd say just like a scenic walk with all like the autumn colors.
Cooking together, windows open, doors open. You know, I want the air to come in, leaves swirl around.
Climbing some trees and going for a nice walk.
Go to some park, have a picnic.
Ideal fall date would be walking around along West River Road.
I would say going apple picking. I don't know what it's called. The place over by Stillwater is really nice. Okay. And then maybe walking around at the town of Afton, having an ice cream cone, and then heading home and watching some evening football.
Red wine and, I don't know, in a cabin or something. And
maybe going or biking down to the river and having a nice vegan picnic.
I don't know, just a walk around campus and then maybe going to a movie, going to Dinky Town for dinner or something. And
well, I was married on October the 8th, and it was colorful with orange and red leaves, and it was interesting and great, and even trees in the aisles of the wedding with orange and yellow leaves, and it was beautiful, and I like fall.
From the ancient Greeks to the online geeks, people have been trying to get you to bid on goods for more than 1,000 years. Producer Markita Fornoff talked about contemporary changes in this ancient practice with two fast-talking Minnesota-bred women who are international auctioneer champions.
My mother, when she attended auction school in 1969, was told by the auction school owner at that time, he had said, "You just pack your things up and you just go home. There's no place for a woman here."
Today, Carol Reinhardt, her daughter, and granddaughter are all professionally trained auctioneers. Her daughter, Kaya Kokish, graduated from the same school that tried to turn Reinhardt away.
It's tough for a good old boy, and I mean the older set, to look at a woman and think that we have any knowledge about, for instance, their farm equipment or their cattle or their logging equipment, which just simply is not true.
At auctioneering college, Kokish and Christine Fladbo-Denick learned how to call.
You do a lot of number drills like 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 55, 60. And then you do a lot of tongue twisters. For instance, big brown bear, but a big black bug, big brown bear, but a big black bug, big brown bear, but a big black bug.
But they were also taught about the business. Weeks before a sale happens, the auction firm takes an inventory of each item's condition. They take photos and research how much each piece of equipment or hand-painted china is worth. From there, they draw up a contract with the seller, create and circulate ads, and in the days leading up to the sale, they'll finally set up the arena. Again, Fladbo-Denick.
Preparation is so key in this business. The actual auction day, like the night of the benefit auction or the day of the real estate farmland auction, that is 10% of the work, maybe even 5%.
So before investing in an auction, they have to make sure that the sellers and the company will see a return for their time.
Because what it takes to make a successful auction is drawing items. Now, that's a funny term if you've never heard it, but a drawing item is what makes you stop your day and come to the live auction, where if all they give us are the nuts and bolts and the Tupperware and the lamps, it's impossible to have a successful auction. We can still get rid of those, but we also need the truck, the car, maybe even the real estate, the cattle, to get people to come and spend the day.
Convincing the younger generation to keep big ticket items can be a tough sell, but it gives them more options, like selling items simulcast.
We will list an auction and create a catalog for certain items, and then as we're selling them in real time, live on site, we offer an internet person to be a representative for online bidders. That representative will give us the bids as they come on his computer, and we treat it just as if they're sitting in the crowd in front of us.
technology is definitely a part of our auctioneering world, and we just take it seller by seller where we decide, do we need to have a live auction plus an online auction? Do we need a online only or a live? But I think personally there is nothing like the live auctioneer chant.
And according to Kokish, an auction isn't just a sale, it's an event.
It's a way for them to socialize, network, and get out.
But it's also a competition.
Oftentimes when you're bidding only online, whether it be eBay or something like that, you don't ever see who you're competing with. You can see that they bid again, but you know exactly how much time you have to get another bid in there or to outbid them. Where in the live auction process, you're sitting in a room or standing outside and you're viewing the item as it's being sold. You can see who's bidding against you because they're standing right there. It's a whole different competitive nature.
And sometimes it's personal.
If we're selling the family farm, you know, that is oftentimes a lifetime of hard work. And we really see our job as twofold. We want to get every dollar possible for our seller, and of course that's good for us too, but equally, and we were raised this way, we want the experience for the seller and the buyer to be really good.
After all, it's a family business for Fladbo Dunick too.
So in 1978, my father said to my mother, he said, I'm going to do one of two things. I'm either going to buy a herd of dairy cattle, or I'm going to go to auction school. And my mother, she knew how difficult and how much work it is to be a dairy farmer. And she said, by golly, you are going to auction school.
Has your dad said that he's happy with your mom's decision to pick auctioneering school over dairy cows?
Yeah, he says it all the time. He is so excited to be an auctioneer at 70. He loves this business as much as he did 20 years ago and 30 and 35 years ago. And what brings our father so much joy is us three kids in the business working alongside of him.
For Culture Q, I'm Markita Fornoff.
I'm Maddie Hamilton, and I'm a reporter here at Culture Q.
And my name is Parker Lemke, and I'm also a reporter for Culture Q.
And this week, we decided to count down the top 7 grossest flavors you wouldn't want in your coffee.
Yeah, and before we start off, I don't actually drink coffee, so probably not the best person to have on this, but we'll see.
So number 7, we have popcorn. I think popcorn would be the really disgusting flavor to put in your coffee, because if you were having a popcorn ball on Halloween, it would probably be salty and good, but it'd probably be hard to capture that flavor and put it into a coffee seasonal flavor shot.
And just on your own, you wouldn't mix popcorn and coffee normally. You wouldn't bring a coffee to drink with your popcorn at a movie theater.
Number 6, we have candy corn. I don't know if the yellow, orange, and white are all 3 different flavors, but I feel like that would be really difficult to put into a coffee. It would probably be disgusting because it would taste way too sweet.
Candy on its own is great, but a candy-flavored coffee sounds a little gross. Way too sweet.
I agree. So number 5, we have dinner rolls.
What kind of dinner rolls?
I'm thinking the dinner rolls that you would get at Thanksgiving that everyone loves. My friends and I were actually just at Yogurt Lab, and we noticed that they have a peanut butter and jelly flavored frozen yogurt. And we were wondering what it would be like to have bread flavored frozen yogurt. But I think that bread flavored anything, especially coffee, would be horrifically disgusting.
At number 4, we have mashed potatoes. Now, I used to not like mashed potatoes when I was a kid, but when I did try it, I really liked it. So maybe the same thing will be for coffee for me. But you don't want to be mixing coffee with a seasonal flavor that's mashed potato flavored. I don't even know how you do that.
Probably not. I mean, they're just as buttery as popcorn.
At number 3 is something I don't think people really like on its own. It's definitely a seasonal thing, but
number 3 is fruitcake. I don't know anybody that likes... Okay, I take that back. I know one person that likes fruitcake, but I think that would be probably close to the worst thing you could ever put into any kind of drink.
Well, it's obviously not the worst thing for us, since we still have 2 things on our list. And at number 2 is something I really like, but I know that...
Okay, I don't like this, but number 2, we have turkey stuffing. It's kind of similar to bread. It has a pretty chunky consistency. There's probably a mix of flavors in there. I mean, it might be interesting going along with the Thanksgiving theme if we could come up with some kind of coffee flavor that was like an everlasting gobstopper where you could like taste Thanksgiving as you're drinking your coffee. But I think stuffing would be a pretty bad part of that.
Yeah, I could eat stuffing by the bucket if I wanted to. But yeah, you don't want to be putting it in your coffee.
And this brings us to number one. The number one grossest flavor that you could ever put in your coffee is probably lutefisk. If you're unfamiliar with lutefisk, according to Wikipedia, it's a traditional dish of Nordic countries, and it's described as being gelatinous in texture and has a pungent odor. Yeah, I don't think there's really anything else that needs to be said.
Yeah.
I think lutefisk would be probably the worst thing.
But is there something you would recommend to people?
I like the pumpkin spice lattes that they already serve at Starbucks and the peppermint mochas they have at Christmas. So there you have it. Top seven grossest flavors you wouldn't want in your coffee.
Yeah, and I still don't know anything about coffee, so you can probably tell by that.
For Culture Q, I'm Maddie Hamilton.
And I'm Parker Lemke, and we're signing off. If you ask what you had for breakfast, this is what she'd say. Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam, butterscotch clouds and a tangerine, a side on a ham. If you set your mind free, baby. We're all connected in the sense that we all live on the same Earth. The intricate balance of nature is illustrated by Sonia Peterson in her ongoing exhibition at an art hotel in downtown Minneapolis. Producer Matt Curtis finds out about this connection between man and nature, and how even so-called seemingly useless parts have a place to stay.
On the outskirts of the University of Minnesota's East Bank, amongst the warehouses and office estates, lies a faceless building. With quiet long corridors and entirely sterilized white walls, its disturbingly clean aesthetics were enough to fool me. It certainly didn't feel like the home of an art studio. As we entered one of the rooms, a burst of vibrancy hit me.
My messy studio full of stuff.
I can definitely see that.
Containing some of the work you'll find on the Hennepin Avenue High Street all this month. This is the work of the U of M graduate, Sonia Peterson. Although she has settled in this space to do the majority of her art, she has been all over the Twin Cities, a graduate of the U and MCAD, a previous resident of the Northeast metro area, and now employed by the U's art department. Sonia has had her fair share of the Minneapolis art scene.
Currently, I do large-scale paper cuts, hanging landscapes. I also do large collages, and then I like to delve into different media.
She recently opened a show at the Burnett Gallery on Hennepin, under the title Seemingly Useless Parts. But the title itself is far from irrelevant.
From a paragraph by Aldo Leopold, who was kind of started the land ethics movement, and he was kind of referring to taking small pieces of nature for granted and not realizing how connected everything is. And my work's always kind of been associated with pulling out connections and showing networks.
Her style is easily recognizable by the convoluted squiggles entwined with nature and man, but these aren't just added for style. They represent the links we have with Earth itself.
The idea of coming full circle, looking back into time in the consideration of that the world was once one place, Pangaea, focusing on the world of trade or how we're trading commodities of nature and bringing them to different, transporting them to different parts of the world.
To work successfully and sustainably, humanity's and nature's relationship should be give and take, though it's a lot more take and a lot less give. These supposed connections we have with the world have been fraying for some time. Since the era of international trade, humans have treated the world like a playground, but the ecological balance of the Earth is just too fragile.
Nature is not a commodity. We do not control it. Experiencing that every day as global warming is happening, as we're seeing invasive species, bee colonies collapse and whatnot, and we're learning about how things are connected.
Well, invasive species are those that are generally not native to a given area, and when they come to that area, they're able to take off rapidly in population. They outcompete the native species. They're able to spread here. whatever factors were limiting their populations on their home continent are not present here, so they're really able to spread and their populations are able to get quite large very quickly.
This is the voice of Dr. Lee E. Freelich, Research Associate and Director of the University of Minnesota Center for Forest Ecology.
When I was about 12, I decided I would become a forest ecologist. People thought it was kind of strange. People still think it's strange.
He has been at the U for 25 years, specializing in disturbances within nature, often catalyzed by humanity, such as the spreading and exposure of the aforementioned invasive species.
But people don't see those things at the time. You know, when they first introduce these invasive species, they don't realize the extent the damage that could eventually be done.
Dr. Freelich believes being unresourceful and taking the earth for granted is embedded within humanity, so it'll take a lot to make a change.
Yes, I think people are kind of irresponsible. They think that they can degrade the environment kind of to an infinite degree, and it's not until you get to a point where it's hard to fix things that people realize what's happened. Maybe as we encounter more and more of these problems and we have many environmental problems going on at once, maybe it will become a new cultural standard. I hope that that will happen, or that it is starting to happen.
I think that we, as a species, or as humanity, need to be more aware of where we fit in the bigger picture and be aware of our actions and conscious of it, and how each one of us is a manager of nature individually in our daily actions.
We must not be reapers of the land, but stewards of the earth. This is Matt Curtis with Culture Q.
And now, folks, our lesson in motion winds down. Tonight you heard stories from Mitch Skinner, Katie Bolin, Marquita Fornoff, Parker Lemke, Maddie Hamilton, and Matt Curtis. Producers for Culture Q are Marquita Fornoff, Amy Friedman, and Matt Curtis. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and I'm Mitch Skinner. Culture Q is online at radiok.org. We're also on Facebook, iTunes, and Twitter. It's now the end of our show, but we'll start up again next week with a look at wildlife and the afterlife. We'll see you then. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby.
Support for this program is brought to you by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.